We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I'm your guest host, Stephen Lyons. Today we have the pleasure of having a conversation with Thant Minh Yu, the author of Where China Meets India, Burma and the New Crossroads of Asia. The book has recently been published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Dr. Thant is the author of The River of Lost Footsteps, A Personal History of Burma, and he was a guest on this show a couple of years ago. He was born in the United States but has spent much of his life in Burma, the native country of his parents. He was educated at Harvard and Cambridge universities and later taught history as a fellow at Trinity College, Cambridge. He's also served on peacekeeping operations in Cambodia and the former Yugoslavia, as well with the United Nations Secretariat in New York. He's the grandson of former UN Secretary General Yu Thant. Commenting on his newest book, Where China Meets India, The Economist magazine writes, "A blend of personal reminiscence, history, enlivened with an eye for the telling anecdote, travelogue, and polemic." Kirkus Reviews calls it, quote, "an illuminating look at a country torn between two superpowers in a whirlwind tour through Burma's history, politics, culture, and geography. Minh Yu makes a successful case for its importance in South Asia's future." To join our conversation, call 333-9455 if you're local, or toll-free if you're out of the area at 1-800 or just 800-222-9455. To give a flavor of this remarkable book, let me read a brief section from the prologue. "Several years ago, I began noticing the news reports of schemes that promised nothing less than a new map of Asia. There were plans from China to join the interior of that vast country to the shores of the Indian Ocean. New highways would slice through the highlands of Burma and link the Chinese hinterland directly both to India and to the warm waters of the Bay of Bengal. A great port would be constructed along the bay where oil tankers would offload African and Middle Eastern oil to be transported along a new 1,000-mile-long pipeline. There has even been talk of dredging the upper reaches of Burma's Irrawaddy River to allow giant cargo ships access to China's most remote inland regions. There are reports from India, too, and Indian ambitions appeared no less modest. With their look-east policy, successive Indian governments since the 1990s have sought to revive and strengthen age-old ties to the Far East, across the sea, and overland across Burma, creating new connections over mountains and jungle. For millennia, India and China have been separated by near impenetrable jungle, deadly malaria, and fearsome animals, as well as by the Himalayas and the high wastelands of the Tibetan Plateau. China and India have taken shape as entirely distinct civilizations, strikingly dissimilar in race, language, and customs. To reach India from China, or vice versa, monks, missionaries, traders, and diplomats had to travel by camel and horse thousands of miles across the oasis towns and deserts of Central Asia and Afghanistan, or by ship over the Bay of Bengal and then through the Straits of Malacca to the South China Sea. The new schemes could change all that. Just as global economic power is shifting to the east, the geography of Asia is changing as well." Welcome to Focus 580, Dr. Thant.
Thank you.
Why did you write this book?
I guess it was at that time, about 4 years ago, when, as you've just read, I began noticing these reports. I mean, there's some reporting on Burma in the news, but it's always about the democracy movement, it's about the human rights situation there, it's about the local politics, the military dictatorship. But I began noticing that there were these other stories that were coming out, not so much in the Western media, but in the local Burmese media and in the Chinese media as well, about all of these schemes. And I had this sense that this was actually a very big story. I had some understanding of the history of the region, about what you had just said or what you had just read about Burma always having been this barrier or obstacle between India and China rather than a connection, and that if this barrier was going to disappear, as it seems to be happening over these few years, and instead Burma was going to be this connection, it would be this incredibly profound shift in the geography of Asia. So the starting point for me was this curiosity about whether or not this was actually happening, what it actually meant on the ground, and also an opportunity for me to both literally explore this area, to travel around Burma, southwestern China, eastern India, and also to understand a little bit about the history of all these regions as well.
Let's begin with geography. You write that geography is key in Burma to understanding its history, its current ethnic makeup, and its possible futures. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's, you know, if you think about, if you imagine the map of Asia in your mind and you have India, then Burma, then China kind of in a row, it seems like all of these countries border each other. But in fact, the most important thing about the geography of this connection is that eastern India or northeastern India, Burma, and southwestern China, the bits that actually connect or up against each other, are incredibly mountainous regions. It's not the Himalayas itself, but it's incredibly mountainous, incredibly rough terrain. And what that's meant is that the little valley that's in the middle, the Irrawaddy Valley, which is Burma proper, has been cut off or isolated from India and China in many ways. I mean, there's been influences over the centuries, but it's been relatively isolated. If you go to India, you have, you know, this billion people now, many of whom speak very closely related languages. In China, you have more than a billion Chinese people speaking interrelated Chinese dialects. But then in the middle, in Burma and in these adjacent parts of India and China, in this mountainous region, you have literally hundreds of completely different languages and dialects and dozens of completely different cultures and peoples. And I think a lot of people don't have a sense of this mountainous and formerly isolated region that's right in the middle of India and China.
Indeed, you write that the Burma lies halfway between Delhi and Mumbai to the west and Shanghai and Hong Kong to the east.
What's yes, this? And it's, you know, but it doesn't seem like that in a way. I mean, you don't really think of, and Burma really hasn't been, up until now at least, part of this image that we have of the rise of Asia and even the threat of Asia as this growing economic superpower. Burma hasn't really been a part of that story, and partly it's because of its isolation. I mean, it's been self-imposed to an extent. There have been Western sanctions against it, but it's also this natural geography, which means that it's not been on the crossroads between India and China before. I mean, it's only, I think, a year ago that National Geographic discovered in the mountains of northeast India near Burma a people that were speaking a language that had never been discovered before. So even now we're still discovering these incredibly remote mountain communities, almost entirely cut off from at least the broader international community.
And moving even farther west than that, I know we've discovered endangered species that were never discovered before in Vietnam, for instance.
Yes, absolutely. It's really a whole sort of mountain complex or upland complex that stretches from the foothills of the Himalayas in places like Nepal, then all the way across northeast India to Burma, to Laos, and to parts of Vietnam, and also in the highlands of Yunnan in China as well, where you have all of these different peoples, as well as what had been a very rich ecosystem. It was a very densely forested place with very few people. And that was the constant in Asian geography for thousands of years, that this was an area that people didn't really go through. So when Marco Polo arrived in southwestern China, he stopped there. He didn't go on. He didn't go then to Burma and then to India. He then, when he went home, had to sail all the way around. So Burma was his block, and it's this constant in Asian geography that's changing now.
You travel to the northeast corner of Burma, somewhat independent territory, or very independent territory, controlled by the United Wa State Army, which is a former anti-government rebel force, I believe, now the drug lords and allies of the military dictatorship. And I guess it's a good point to remind our readers that Burma is under control of the longest-standing military dictatorship in the world, started in 1962, I believe. This region has one of the largest private armies in the world, controlling a territory larger than Belgium, and an important player in the China-Burma borderlands. You write, the dirt roads become Chinese highways, and much of the Wa zone is on Chinese electricity and even its internet and mobile phone grid. Blackberries don't work in Rangoon, but they do in the Wa area. It's a stunning reversal in Burma's geography. What had been remote is now closer to the center. What were muddy mountain hamlets are now more modern than Rangoon. This is astonishing to me. Is this happening with the blessings of the Burmese military leaders? And what really is the new center for Burma?
Well, I mean, when I say the new center, I really mean China, in the sense that China has become a far richer and more dynamic and economically more powerful place than Burma. And this is actually, you know, a recent thing, historically speaking. I mean, Burma in the 1920s and 30s, and even to some extent in the 50s, was a much more prosperous an advanced place than China, and of course that's not the case today. And in Burma, because it had been so isolated, you know, on the peripheries of Burma, you had these groups like the Wa, which is a tribal people way up in the mountains, who in British times were known as headhunters, naked headhunters, sort of beyond the pale of civilization and even beyond the pale of any kind of real British colonial supervision. And this people had become part of this insurgency, a broader insurgency that has engulfed parts of the country for decades. And they now have their own army, the United Wa State Army, which is the biggest private army in the world, bigger than the Taliban in Afghanistan, with surface-to-air missiles, with, you know, proper troops. They have connections in China, so they buy their arms in China. The Chinese have given them tacit support over the years. And it's not really true that they're an ally of the Burmese government. It's just that the Burmese army and they have signed a ceasefire. And so there hasn't been fighting between them and the Burmese government for 20 years, or almost, or actually more than 20 years. This ceasefire looked like it was going to break down a year ago, but it's been reconfirmed recently. So you have this little autonomous area, not little, again, it's, as you said, about the size of Belgium, between Burma and China. And it's just one of many in this sort of strange patchwork along the border.
We're speaking with Thant Minh Yeu. He's the author of Where China Meets India. To join our conversation locally, call 333-9455. Out of the area, 800-222-9455. We spoke a minute ago about the natural resources in the area. And this insatiable appetite of Asia, especially China, for exotic and endangered animals is extremely disturbing to me. You write about this as part of Burma's appeal to the Chinese. What did you witness on your trip there?
Yeah, it's a small part of China's sort of market interest in Burma, but you're right. I mean, it's a terrible thing, and you can see in the markets, not just in the little border towns there, but even in the center of Burma, in Mandalay, people, mainly either Chinese or brokers for the Chinese market, buying animal parts, the parts of rare endangered animals, including tigers. Burma used to have a very large tiger population. Now it's dwindled to almost nothing. I mean, the tigers in Burma are on the verge of extinction. And so you see tiger parts, but also other animals, very rare animals you have in Burma, like rhinoceros, snow leopards in the very far north, other animals. And yes, I mean, there's no market in Burma for this, but there is a big market, as we all know, in China for traditional Chinese medicines.
Is there no policing of this? If you're walking through towns, you can see this out in the open in the public?
Yeah, I mean, there is to some extent. I mean, there are laws, and there's going to be an attempt to both update these laws and enforce these laws. But Burma is a very poor country, and even though it's been a military dictatorship for a long time, it's not a totalitarian dictatorship in the sense that it controls everything. I mean, it's the kind of place where, in the past, if you got up and organized a demonstration, you probably, you know, wind up in jail. But otherwise, government is quite weak, and supervision is quite weak, and there are very few social services, and so, you know, a lot of things happen in Burma with no connection to government, and so it's hard for the government, or it's been hard, even if they wanted to police these things. And of course, there's a lot of corruption as well, so it's easy to pay off the local authority. And a lot of the regions where, you know, there are many animals, big animals left, exotic, endangered animals left, are areas that have been close to armed conflict or close to areas where these different militia have enjoyed a degree of autonomy. And so, you know, there's it's been that much harder to establish any real protection of these endangered species.
One other commodity that came out in your book, there's a robust appetite for Burma's, quote, imperial jade, with sales over $1 billion annually. What is so valuable about imperial jade?
Well, the big consumers of jade and the connoisseurs of jade in the world are the Chinese, and I don't really know the history of why this has been the case, but the Chinese have for centuries valued this particular type and particular color of jade, which is called imperial jade, which is essentially found only in Burma. I think Burma has about 95% of the world's imperial jade. And the value of this has gone up over the past several years. And the government organizes, the Burmese government organizes auctions where private businessmen, private traders, sell this jade, and literally tens of thousands of Chinese businessmen come to these auctions in Burma to buy them. And last year was the most profitable sale so far, where over these three auctions, actually something like $5.5 billion worth of precious stones and gems, overwhelmingly jade, was sold.
Let's turn to the east now, toward China, and talk a little bit about China's historical engagement with Burma. Your book is a wonderful history lesson, as well as a wonderful travelogue. I wonder if you can give us a sense of China's historical engagement with Burma.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's important to remember is that even though Burma borders on China today, that wasn't the case before. And until very, very recently, until the 20th century, essentially, there were many other kingdoms and peoples and principalities and tribes and everything else that were between the Kingdom of Burma, which has existed since medieval times, and the Chinese Empire, different Chinese empires. And, you know, some Chinese empires, like the Mongols, got all the way to Burma. Others were far away. And again, there were many other peoples in between. The history has been one where some of these Chinese empires, again, like the Mongols, but also the Manchus, the Ming dynasty in the 1400s, invaded Burma. But none of them were able to actually annex Burma or to conquer it. But what has happened is that over the centuries, with many ups and downs, there's been this steady movement of the Chinese frontier towards Burma. So the heartland of China used to be 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, very, very far away, more than 1,000 miles away. And slowly, over the past centuries, or especially over the past three, four centuries, that Chinese frontier has come closer and closer. It's a bit like a colonial frontier. It's like the Russian frontier moving into Siberia. It's like the American frontier moving west in the 19th, 18th, and 19th centuries. You had this much less known Chinese frontier moving to the southwest, incorporating gradually indigenous peoples, overrunning, conquering indigenous peoples, moving Chinese culture, settlers, military outposts, crushing local tribal rebellions, winning over local tribal chiefs, and getting closer and closer to Burma. And it really wasn't until the 1960s that Chinese control really was firmly entrenched on what is today the Burma-China border.
You know, we think of colonialism as something that happened in the past, but it seems to be currently happening as well.
Well, I mean, in China, you had, you know, in the 1940s, late 1940s, after the Chinese Revolution, you had the Chinese incorporation by force of mm-hmm. Tibet and Xinjiang, the Turkish-speaking Muslim region to the northwest. And in this province close to Burma, in Yunnan, you had all of these still autonomous or semi-independent peoples. And in the 1950s and 60s, their independence was ended, and they were forcefully incorporated, for better or for worse, into the People's Republic of China. And there was a lot of repression at that time. And now this area is completely integrated into the rest of China. So for those people, and Yunnan remains about 40% composed of different ethnic minorities, for those people, the history of the last 50 years is not just the history of Chinese communism coming to their area, but also of this Sinification of their area, of Chinese cultural of this Chinese cultural frontier sort of reaching their area, and they and their kids becoming much more part of China.
You pose some critical questions regarding China's role in the region. I want to read a couple of those questions. Was China the emerging superpower? Was China the emerging superpower? And later you go on to say it's actually a re-emerging superpower. We'll get to that in a second. The emerging superpower going to be a responsible neighbor, quietly making possible an end to decades of war, building infrastructure, investing in the economy, and bringing Burma into the 21st century? Or was China a plundering behemoth, grasping everything within its reach without concern for the environment or the rights of individuals or communities? For a poor country like Burma, being next to China, the economic powerhouse of the world, should be a huge advantage, but will it? At a time when Chinese influence around the world was starting to be felt more strongly than ever, Burma was the canary in the coal mine. Has your research and travels provided you with answers to those questions?
A little bit. I mean, on the one hand, it's, you know, if you look at the Burma example, as with I think some other examples around the world, it's very easy to blame China in the sense of Chinese companies that have come in because they don't seem to to care very much for the environment. You have, with the push of Chinese business into Burma, all the things that we had talked about before in terms of, you know, the market for endangered animals and everything else. But at a wider scale, I mean, these huge infrastructure projects that don't seem to be concerned for local communities, the impact on local communities, on the environment and everything else. So in one way, it seems very easy to blame the Chinese and to say, you know, compared to other countries, perhaps the Chinese are not acting in a responsible way. But then, you know, I think you have to balance that with a couple of things. First is that, you know, many other countries, also many other Western countries and the companies of corporations and many other of Western companies haven't had a great track record as well in many parts of the world. So it's not as if you know, businesses from elsewhere in the world are always environmentally friendly and always, you know, treating local communities or very concerned about local communities. And also, secondly, you know, in some ways the primary responsibility rests with the Burmese government. I think that it's the Burmese government that hasn't been able to, in some ways, get its act together and manage this relationship with China in the best way possible for its own people. Because, as you had just read, I mean, I think it should be a great thing to be next to the most economically vibrant economy in the world, and there should be so many ways in which Burma should be able to benefit from this. But it's really up to Burma, Burmese people, Burmese government, to make sure that this happens and that things are properly regulated, that there isn't this environmental damage, that, you know, the investment that comes in is investment that's good for the people. So, you know, I think, you know, one can criticize almost everyone in this picture. The Chinese economic push into Burma has not been a good thing in many ways, but hopefully this can still change.
We have a caller from Champaign. Caller, go ahead, and thanks for waiting.
Yes, wasn't it turned into Myanmar?
Is that the question? Yes, you're right. Well, it hasn't really turned into Myanmar. Myanmar has always been the Burmese language name for the country. So in Burmese we always say Myanmar. And in English, it's been Burma for a long time, and I use both interchangeably, and many people in the country use both, depending on whether they're speaking English or Burmese. The current Burmese government prefers to use the word Myanmar in English as well. Some in the Burmese opposition don't like this because they say this is something that the military government has decided, and so they won't recognize it. So there's a little bit of a political thing involved as well. But in a way, it's interchangeable. It's actually the same word. Burma is a very old English corruption of the word Myanmar.
Now, wasn't there some ethnic cleansing taking place in there with the Karen people?
It's not really ethnic cleansing. It's more that there has been the Karen people, who are very diverse people, actually. They're partly Christian. They're partly Buddhist. They speak many different dialects. When Burma became independent in 1948, many leaders in the Karen community refused to accept Burmese rule, and they wanted a separate Karen nation and a separate Karen state. And there was a Karen insurgency, which was very successful in the beginning, threatened the government. And over the years has been pushed back to this mountainous area close to Thailand, where they still resist, you know, in pockets, they still resist Burmese control. And so what we've had over the last 10, 20 years are, you know, many waves of not waves, but many clashes and attempts by the Burmese army to finally crush this very long-standing Karen insurgency. So it's not ethnic cleansing in the sense that there's no attempt to move Burmese people into this area. It's more a Burmese army attempt to end this Karen insurgency, which has been there since 1948.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, caller. We'll now take a short break.
On the next Fresh Air, Mark Bowden tells us how the Conficker worm penetrated the operating systems of millions of computers worldwide, linking them together into a powerful supercomputer that can be remotely controlled by Conficker's creators. Bowden is the author of Worm, The First Digital World War. He also wrote Black Hawk Down. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer's Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn incorporates residents' past routines and interests into their daily lives, engaging residents in choices and daily living patterns. More information is available at 384-0100.
We're having a conversation with Thant Minh Thieu, the author of Where China Meets India. The book was just published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Staying with China for a for a moment. You compare China's support of Burma's military regime to the support, the Chinese support of African leaders who are opposed to the West, regimes like the Sudan and Zimbabwe. Aside from these political viewpoints, what do these countries have to offer China?
Well, it's similar in the way that China's main interest in those countries and in Burma has been the natural resources in those countries. And in Burma, you have the natural gas, quite large quantities of natural gas that have been found offshore, as well as mineral reserves in terms of copper, nickel, gold, rare earths, other minerals as well. And I think that's the same with some countries in Africa and Sudan with oil, for example. The big difference, though, and also these are countries where the West has been very critical for the human rights record, because of the human rights record of these governments, and whereas China seems not to be concerned about the human rights record of these governments. The big difference, though, is that, well, two things. One is that in the Burma case, unlike, say, in Zimbabwe or Sudan, in the Burma case, you have this frontier, this 1,000-year-old, 2,000-year-old frontier. It's not like an African country. It's a country which borders China and where China has been kind of moving gradually closer to over a very long period. And secondly, for China right now, the main interest in Burma is not so much its natural resources. That's secondary. The main interest by far, at least by the leadership in Beijing, is to have this strategic access across Burma to the sea. And so for Burma, it's unlike Zimbabwe and Sudan, it's not the gas so much or the minerals, it's the potential of Burma as this bridge to the Indian Ocean.
I think this is a good segue into talking about the U.S. sanctions against Burma. The Economist states that you're controversial among Burmese exiles for advocating engagement with the regime. Again, this regime that's been ineffectively and brutally run by a military dictatorship since 1962. And throughout the book, and I listened to your last interview here, and you also talked about that, you criticized the U.S.'s sanctions against the Burmese government and, in effect, against the Burmese people. When did these sanctions go in effect? Why did we impose them?
And what has been the consequence? The U.S. actually had a very good relationship with the Burmese military government through the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. The old Burmese dictator, Ne Win, was invited to a state visit by Lyndon Baines Johnson in the 1960s. He returned in the 80s and was a guest of the Ronald Reagan White House. And this was during the Cold War, where it was seen as a right-wing military government that the U.S. was more or less comfortable with. And they were at the time actually fighting Chinese-backed communist guerrillas up in the mountains. And then with the end of the Cold War and the emergence of a pro-democracy movement in Burma that was led by Aung San Suu Kyi, the U.S. decided that it could afford to take the sort of moral high ground and support the pro-democracy movement. It didn't really have any business interests or other interests in the country. And as part of this support, it imposed or gradually began to impose economic sanctions, beginning with an aid cutoff in 1988, 1989, and going up to President Clinton's decision to cut off new U.S. investment in the late 90s, and then President Bush's decision to ban any imports from Burma, as well as impose very severe financial sanctions, essentially cutting the country off from the international banking system. And I've always argued, really since the beginning, since the early 1990s, that it's right for the U.S. and it's good for the U.S. to take the moral high ground and to focus on democracy and human rights issues. But sanctions itself and these economic embargoes and aid cutoffs have been entirely counterproductive.
Aren't we, in effect, creating an economic vacuum that China is just anxious to move right into?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess in the early 1990s, maybe that was difficult to see. But China today in 2011 is completely different than China in the early 1990s. And I think somewhere along the way between then and now, people should have factored in China and realized that, simply imposing Western sanctions or U.S. sanctions wasn't going to pressure this military government. And instead, there was this huge and growing economic power right next door that was clearly going to enter the vacuum. And what it's done, in effect, is it's skewed things. And so you don't have Western companies or any companies going into, say, the manufacturing sector, as in Vietnam, into the garment industry, into the tourism sector, that could actually create jobs. You don't have companies that are actually interested in social responsibility and in some ways helping the country through their investment. What you do have are companies, mainly Chinese, but not just Chinese companies, who are simply interested in natural resource extraction and really have no concern for anything else. And so I think it's been very counterproductive in many ways. And a big part of Western sanctions is also this aid cutoff. That Burma is the only country in the world, or one of the very, very few countries in the world, that receives no international development assistance from the World Bank, the IMF, the Asian Development Bank, or the UN. And one can also argue that this has been very counterproductive as well.
Mm-hmm. You do encourage us to visit Burma. And on the subject of Rangoon, the city, you describe a diverse city where already Chinese and Indian shops are popping up in a somewhat friendly collision. But it's long since been a diverse city, hasn't it?
Well, yeah. It's been, from the very beginning, Rangoon was a city before the British came in the early 1800s, and even before that, you had Armenian traders, you had English traders as well, Chinese, Indians, and during the British period in the late 19th and early 20th century, Rangoon became this great cosmopolitan hub. It was 5% Jewish, for example. It even had a Jewish mayor in the 1920s. It was about 60% people from all across India, from the Punjab, from the Afghan border, from Bengal, from Bombay, from elsewhere. It had a lively Chinese community, but from many different parts of China, speaking different dialects. There were Europeans there. Pablo Neruda, the Chilean poet, lived there in the 1920s. John Gielgud performed Hamlet there in the 1940s. You had a very diverse community, and Rangoon then was very much on the international scene. It was where if you flew from British Airways or BOAC in those days from London to Australia, you would stop in Rangoon. Most international flights in the region had Rangoon as a hub. That's, of course, no longer the case, but there was a time when Rangoon was very much on the map.
Before we turn to the west, toward India, you traveled to Mandalay, once the capital of Burma, and later a city of British India. I'm fascinated by what lies within a 700-mile radius, I guess you could say, proximity to Mandalay. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, it was just something that struck me when I was walking around in Mandalay, and I looked at an atlas and drew a radius. And if you draw this circle around Mandalay with about 700 or so miles, what you get is, of course, pretty much all of Burma, almost all of Burma, but you also get the southwest of China, which includes Sichuan province. You get Laos, you get most of Thailand, including Bangkok. You get Bangladesh, which has 160 million people. You get Calcutta and West Bengal in India, and you get the northeast of India, little states like Assam and Manipur, with about 45 million people altogether. But if you take all of that together, that part of eastern India, southwest China, western Thailand and Burma, you get a tenth of the world's population. You get 600 million people, so a little bit less than a tenth of the world's population.
And almost twice the population of the United States, a little less than twice
yes.
the population. A couple of hundred miles to the south of Mandalay is the capital that's been being built since 2004. And I think I recall in Emma Larkin's book, Everything is Broken, how odd she found this new capital. The approach is an eight-lane highway without traffic on it. It's vast and sprawling and eerie. Your thoughts on why the generals decided to move the capital, and how would you describe this place?
Yeah, it's. I've been there, fairly recently in the last few months. I visited first probably around the time Emma Larkin did when it was first the capital, and there was a lot of construction. It's strange. I mean, it's coming to life a little bit. I mean, before there were just these huge buildings and nothing in between. Now there's actually people living there. It's hard to know how many. Maybe a couple of hundred thousand is the total population. On the one hand, it's kind of what you expect. A sort of authoritarian regime to build. It's a huge planned place with enormous highways and big buildings that sort of dwarf everything else. On the other hand, it's a bit like, sort of a housing estate in Arizona or New Mexico, palm trees, golf courses, little resorts, bungalows, as well as some condos and buildings and some shopping malls that you drive into, multiplex cinemas, big supermarkets with four-wheel drives outside. And so it's a mix, and it's I think in terms of why they built it, I think it's also a mix of different things. I mean, I think it's partly the desire by the old dictator General Tan Shui, who retired earlier this year, It was a legacy project. Many Burmese kings in the past built new capitals. So I think that was a factor in his thinking. Mm-hmm. I think, secondly, there has always been this paranoia that the Americans would invade the way they invaded Iraq and overthrow the government, overthrow the regime. And so I think they felt that Rangoon was very exposed, being close to the sea and wanted to be further inland. That could have been a factor. And then lastly, I think it was, there was always this fear of a popular uprising. And in Rangoon, you have a city of 5 million people, government offices there that could be sort of taken over by a mob or by protesters or in an uprising. And that scenario of a popular uprising sort of overthrowing the government by seizing government buildings is no longer possible because the government is now, hundreds of miles far away in their own place.
Let's turn to India. You mentioned that to many in Burma, India is a more familiar place than China. In fact, for you, India is not really a foreign country. Your great-grandfather studied in Calcutta. Your grandfather had portraits of Gandhi and Nehru in his house. India also piqued your interest as a scholar. Are Indians as interested in Burma? And is the reverse true?
I think to some extent. Burma has a strange place in the Indian imagination. It's not familiar in the way that, say, Pakistan is. In many ways, India faces a little bit more to the west and to the east. There's more awareness of places like Afghanistan than there is of places like Burma, even. At the same time, Burma was a province of British India, and so many, hundreds of thousands, millions of Indian families, Indians today, have family connections to Burma, of an uncle who lived there or a grandparent who was born there or something else. India was, for many Indians or for India in the 1920s and 30s, like America today, it was a place that a lot of young people went to recreate themselves, to make a better life, to look for jobs. Burma was actually a much richer place than India at the time, and millions of Indians immigrated there. But then when Burma became very isolated under the military in the 60s, the kind of wall came down, and I think for many young Indians today, Burma is an extremely unfamiliar place. There's a kind of memory of it as a place where maybe someone in their family had gone a long time ago, but it's a place where very few Indians have any living connections today.
We're speaking with Thant Minh Yu. He's the author of Where China Meets India, Burma and the New Crossroads of Asia. What is India's Look East policy? I believe this began in the 1990s when India wanted to engage more with the increasingly prosperous nations of the Far East.
I mean, it's meant a few different things. I mean, the original idea was just that, at a time when these countries in the East, Korea and Japan, Japan for a long time, but Korea and Singapore and Malaysia and Thailand and all had become, much more economically vibrant in, by the 90s, that India shouldn't just be, sort of obsessed with Pakistan and looking towards older markets, perhaps, but should also be looking east and should actively be trying, as it opened up to the world economically, to develop links with these vibrant economies in the Far East. So that's one way to think about it, and that has happened to some extent. But another sort of different way of thinking about the Look East policy or ways in which some people have tried to interpret it is to also think more about Burma as a bridge to this other part of Asia, and also to think about India's own northeast, which has been so isolated and underdeveloped and conflict-stricken for decades, as also this gateway. So one way of thinking about the Look East policy is that it's a desire also to open up the northeast of India to Burma and then from Burma to the rest of Asia as well.
I was fascinated by a section of your book where you said that most of the last 2,000 years, India, not China, has enjoyed closer relations with Southeast Asia. I found that fascinating. I wonder if you could talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you actually travel in the region or certainly read the history of the region, it's evident in many ways. I mean, if you go to Thailand, not just Burma, but you go to Thailand, Cambodia, Indonesia, Bali, certainly, the religions, Buddhism, Hinduism are Indian. The alphabets that we use are Indian. The old source of knowledge, scientific knowledge, the inspiration for a lot of local arts is Indian. And so, India was always this huge civilization to the west that was very accessible because it was just across the Bay of Bengal, which was very easy to sail across. And because of this religious connection as well as everything else, it was a place that was really looked up to as this cultural as a cultural connection.
Why did India abandon its support for Burma's pro-democracy movement?
Well, I think India, you know, by the mid-1990s, felt that this policy of sanctions and isolation and taking a very hard-line approach towards the military government, one, failed entirely in the sense that it didn't seem to be dislodging the military government or weakening it at all, and instead was creating this vacuum into which China was entering. And they felt, many Indian policymakers felt, that you know, the West had the luxury of continuing with a policy that didn't really work because there was really no cost to the United States of a failed policy in Burma. But to India, it really couldn't afford a failed policy, and it couldn't afford a Burma that was coming that much under Chinese domination. So the rationale was that it needed to counterbalance Chinese influence in the country. And, you know, relatedly also, India has its own security problems in the northeast. There are multiple insurgencies in India's own northeast, and it wanted the cooperation of the Burmese army against these rebel groups and militant groups on the Indian side.
And I know they've talked about a trans-Asia highway. What will this do for India, and more importantly, what will this do for Burma?
Yeah, I mean, there are all these links that are happening. I mean, it's even hard to keep up with all the different discussions. The biggest project, actually, it was signed only after my book was finished, so I haven't fully mentioned it there, is a $23 billion high-speed rail project that will link China, Beijing, to Rangoon and to the sea on the Burmese coast. And ultimately, the Chinese hope that this rail line will continue on from Burma to India, to Tehran, to Istanbul, and then link up with the European rail network in one direction. And in the other direction, we'll continue on from, you know, from Rangoon to the heartland of China and Beijing to the Trans-Siberian Railway and to Moscow. And so Burma will be part of this great railway grid that the Chinese want to build and be a part of. There are also plans between Thailand and India to build highways that, or perhaps even in the future rail lines that will connect Bangkok to eastern India across Burma. Bangladesh and China have talked about linking up by rail and highway again across Burma. So for all of these countries, China, India, Bangladesh, Thailand, with a combined population of, 2.5, almost 3 billion people, Burma's right in the middle.
Do you have faith that these huge projects will actually be completed? Are they more plans than reality, or do you think that, I mean, it may depend on the world economy and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say yes, except for what you had just mentioned. I mean, with the world economy the way it is, who knows what things will look like in a year's time. But with the railway project, and because China has this track record of finishing these infrastructure projects extremely quickly, they plan to finish this high-speed railway by 2016, which is not very far off, 4.5 years from now, and the work is beginning quite soon. Whether or not some of these other things happen, I think is a little bit more questionable. I think on the Indian side, there's a very mixed view of this thing. On the one hand, there are people in India who want to open up, who want this access to China across Burma, who want the borders in the northeast to open up. But then, because they have this history of instability and rebellion in that part of India, there are a lot of security people, Indian Army people and others, who are very wary of opening too many new roads and border points and everything else at a time when they're not fully in control of that edge of their country.
Now, you write that in the early part of the 20th century, Burma had a higher standard of living than India. It was far less densely populated, and Indians flocked to Rangoon to fill the need for cheap labor. The city was, as we've talked about before, very diverse and cosmopolitan, but then it all came crashing down. What happened?
Well, in 1962, the army took over under a fairly charismatic general named General Ne Win, and it was his decision and the decision of, I guess, some of the other generals and colonels who were part of the army at the time, that Burma needed to be closed off and it would be better isolated. I mean, there was some, you know, there's some reason to understand that view. It was at a time when the rest of the region was not in very good shape. China was in the middle of the Cultural Revolution, the Vietnam War, the war in Laos, the war in Cambodia was gaining pace. India was poorer than ever. There was about to be another war between India and Pakistan over what became Bangladesh. And so it wasn't as if, you know, Burma was in a great neighborhood and could open up. And so there were multiple insurgencies within Burma And General Ne Win felt that closing off the country, dealing with these insurgencies, trying to deal with these problems internally rather than using outside aid. And I think he also didn't want to be dragged into the Vietnam War and didn't want the Americans to be in Burma helping them actively in their counterinsurgency efforts against the communists. So in some ways one can understand this, but the net effect was terrible for the country because it led to essentially 30 years of economic stagnation and relative decline, and left the country by the 1990s incredibly ill-prepared for a more globalized world and without much ability to kind of reconnect to the world properly in the 1990s.
And you noted by 2009 there were some glimmers of hope as far as the military leaders lessening their grip on Burmese citizens. What was the roadmap to democracy, and was it a real...
It was right to be, I think, skeptical at that time. But actually in the last few months, since the book was completed, things have actually turned in a very good direction. There were elections late last year which were widely condemned as being unfree and unfair, with a lot of vote rigging and everything else. But a new constitutional system was put into place in April. The old dictator, General Than Shwe, retired, and he seems genuinely retired. The junta was actually dissolved at the very beginning of April. It's far from a democracy, but there's a constitutional setup with a president and a cabinet and a parliament, and all this has started to work in a certain way, even though it's still, you know, restricted the political environment. And then, surprisingly in some ways, this new president who took over in April has pushed forward a very aggressive reform agenda. And in a little bit like Gorbachev in the mid-80s, he sort of came out of the system and then suddenly started reforming things in a way that has surprised a lot of observers. He's pushed through a slew of economic reforms on everything from banking, currency reform, investment, agricultural development issues, many other issues. He's reached out to the opposition. He's met with Aung San Suu Kyi, which no Burmese leader had done in a very long time. He's invited exiles to return. He's unblocked all internet websites that have been blocked or censored. The media is much freer than it was even just 6 months ago. NGOs, civil society groups, political parties are forming and meeting much more freely. So there's certainly a different atmosphere, and there's a sense that I would agree with that, you know, we're probably at an inflection point and the best possible opportunity in a very long time to move things in the right direction. Whether or not it actually moves in a very solid direction towards democracy and everything else remains to be seen. But it's certainly we're certainly in a much better situation than even just a year ago.
Are there real economic opportunities for Burmese as far as all this activity with China and India, or is it still a system of cronyism?
Yeah, there's a lot of cronyism. There's a huge amount of corruption. One of the very, you know, sort of good things that the president did was he actually acknowledged this at least for the first time and said, you know, we are in an economic mess. There's a huge amount of poverty. There's a huge amount of corruption that makes almost everything else, good things, impossible. That corruption needs to be stamped out. So at least that's been acknowledged. It's going to be an enormous uphill climb to actually undo this system, this patronage system, this crony system that's developed over decades. But it exists in many other countries in the region as well. So we'll have to see. And you know, I think that China in particular, but India as well, will become an important part, increasingly important part of the Burmese economy. Whether or not the new Burmese government is able to manage this in a way that benefits ordinary Burmese people is probably their biggest test of all. And it's very hard to see how they can do this while Western sanctions remain in place. If Burma is the only country, unlike India and China, that has no access to Western learning and institutions and international development assistance and everything else, and trade and American markets and European markets, it's always going to be in a very junior and unbalanced relationship with China and India. So there's a lot that needs to happen now. The first little steps now have been very welcome and encouraging, but I think most of the hard work is still ahead.
I think of local interest to our Midwest listeners. Recently, there was a meeting with Caterpillar and government officials, and maybe something will come of this.
Yes, I mean, well, you know, under U.S. law, Burmese imports to America are banned, but U.S. exports to Burma are not banned. But most American companies have shied away from doing any business because of financial sanctions as well. It is hard to do business. Also, the Burmese government side has essentially self-sanctioned itself in the sense that it has all kinds of economic policies and laws on the books that positively discourage outside investment. But that is what is changing. There is a real attempt to redo these laws, create a better investment climate. And I think if the new Burmese government creates a better business environment and at the same time does at least something to improve the human rights situation, then hopefully we'll see a relaxation of sanctions and much more trade between Burma and America. That would be great for both countries, and I think it would also be great for the long-term prospects for real democratic change in the country as well.
I think equally fascinating is your noting that in the 16th century, China and India together formed half the world's economy, and that in your view, this could happen again in just a generation. And I thought a great point you made was that China is not an emerging superpower, it's a re-emerging superpower. But I'm wondering, and I think this is the question that comes out of your book, can these two emerging or re-emerging superpowers coexist? And can they coexist in Burma, especially if Chinese domination continues and Burma no longer exists as a buffer zone, but instead becomes a point of engagement? Can Beijing and Delhi peacefully coexist? And I think that's an important question.
Yeah, I think this is something that, you know, people there, whether in Burma, certainly in India and China, are asking themselves as well, you know, what is the future of the relationship between these two huge Asian re-emerging superpowers? And no one knows, and in some ways Burma could be an important test case. I mean, if you have this bad scenario where Burma comes under Chinese domination, where the Burmese don't get their act together, where their government remains a bad government that doesn't manage things properly, and then you have this huge Chinese push to Burma, across Burma to the sea, the Indians get alarmed, and then Burma becomes this point of tension between these two countries, if not now, then 10 years from now, 15 years from now. That would be a really bad thing. But I think there's every reason to think that, you know, one can avoid that, and that instead we enter into this period where, you know, there is competition, there's rivalry, there are new nationalisms in Asia, but essentially everyone's focused on trade and growth and making money and development. Okay. And in a way, you know, Burma is an important part of this little puzzle, or an important little part of this puzzle. And I think a real progress in Burma will make a difference, because it is this in this new connection, place of connection between these two powers. And then related to that is U.S. policy. And I think a change in U.S. policy towards something much more effective, away from sanctions towards something else, will make a difference
yes,
in Burma.
I agree.
And that in turn will make a difference for these two other countries as well.
We've just had a conversation with Thant Minh Yu, the author of Where China Meets India. Thank you so much, Dr. Thant, and good luck with your book.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for listening, and thanks for your call. That's Focus 580 for today. Please stay tuned for the Afternoon Magazine.
If you have this bad scenario where Burma comes under Chinese domination, where the Burmese don't get their act together, where their government remains a bad government that doesn't manage things properly, and then you have this huge Chinese push to Burma, across Burma to the sea, the Indians get alarmed, and then Burma becomes this point of tension between these two countries, if not now, then 10 years from now, 15 years from now. That would be a really bad thing. But I think there's every reason to think that, you know, one can avoid that, and that instead we enter into this period where, you know, there is competition, there's rivalry, there are new nationalisms in Asia, but essentially everyone's focused on trade and growth and making money and development.
Okay.
And in a way, you know, Burma is an important part of this little puzzle, or an important little part of this puzzle. And I think a real progress in Burma will make a difference, because it is this in this new connection, place of connection between these two powers. And then related to that is U.S. policy. And I think a change in U.S. policy towards something much more effective, away from sanctions towards something else, will make a difference
yes,
in Burma.
I agree.
And that in turn will make a difference for these two other countries as well.
We've just had a conversation with Thant Minh Yu, the author of Where China Meets India. Thank you so much, Dr. Thant, and good luck with your book.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for listening, and thanks for your call. That's Focus 580 for today. Please stay tuned for the Afternoon Magazine.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available, and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
And in the minute before 12 o'clock, I'm Jeff Bossert, your host for the Afternoon Magazine, with a look at midday market numbers from Kansas City. Hard red winter wheat for December is 751¾. That's up 7¾. For March, 765¼, up 6½. Chicago December wheat, 659½, up 11¼. And March, 693, up 9¾. December corn, 655¾, up 7¾. 669 for March corn, 669¼, up 8. May, 676¾, up 8. November soybeans, 1265¾, up 6. January, 1277½, up 6¼. March, 1285, up 7. October soybean meal, 328.70, up 250. December, 332.60, up 240. October soybean oil, 52.73, up 51. October live cattle, 120.42½, that's up 70.